Hello, welcome to the second hour of the reading of the Arizona Republic for Thursday, June 5th, 2025. I'm Gene, a volunteer reader with Sun Sounds of Arizona. We begin the second hour by reading the obituaries. Today's list includes just one name, Marilyn Olivia Carangella, 97, of Scottsdale. Sun Sounds of Arizona extends its condolences to the families and friends of the individual we just listed. And now we'll turn to the business section of the paper. Well, it looks like there are three articles on the business page. The top of the page, the article is entitled Short-Term Tourist Rentals Surge in Spain. This is by a Reuters news group from Madrid. The supply of short-term rentals for tourists has jumped 25% in Spain over the last 2 years, a study by tourism lobby group Exceltur found, despite local governments' attempts to curtail them amid a housing crisis. The boom in tourist accommodation is growing at an above-average pace in several of the top 50 tourist municipalities and destinations, which accounted for half of all international visitor arrivals in 2024. Conversely, the number of hotel rooms available grew by just 2% between 22 and 2024, according to official data on the registered tourist accommodations and listings on platforms that were analyzed by Exceltur. Spain has sought ways to restrict the number of homes rented to tourists amid a boom in visitors and protest by residents who blame over-tourism for a spike in rental and home purchase prices. The measures seek to push landlords toward longer-term rentals to residents amid a countrywide deficit of 450,000 homes. That's according to the Bank of Spain. In Barcelona, the mayor banned all permits for short-term rentals by 2028, while Malaga, Madrid, and the Canary Islands are restricting new permits. In late May, the government ordered Airbnb to withdraw more than 65,000 listings that it said violated the existing rules from its platform, and Airbnb said it would appeal. Exceltur's vice president, Oscar Pirelli, told Reuters on June 2nd, quote, "The big problem with these regulations is that with traditional inspections, regional and local governments have been unable to enforce them," unquote. Tourist rentals in Madrid surged by 49% between 2022 and 2024. That represents 38% of the total 176,000 beds for visitors. In Malaga, tourist accommodation increased by 36% in those 2 years, now making up 56% of the offerings to visitors. In Barcelona, a moratorium of several years on rental permits has not yet stemmed growth, with short-term rentals increasing by 26%. Spain is the world's second most popular tourist destination, with 25.6 million international tourists visiting in the first 4 months of this year. And that was the article, Short-Term Tourist Rentals Surge in Spain. Our next article, Airlines Stick to Target for Emissions. This is also a Reuters group, news group article, but it was written by Rajesh Kumar Singh, Shivanish Tiwari, and Tim Heffer, and it comes from New Delhi. Global Airlines wrapped up a two-day summit on June 3rd, sticking to a target of net zero emissions by 2050, but they voiced fresh worries about the availability of greener fuels and new planes. The International Air Transport Association, which represents about 350 airlines, said that hitting the target would cost carriers $4.7 trillion, or $174 billion a year, at least some of which is likely to be passed on as higher fares. Despite earlier signs that some airlines were growing more skeptical about the chances of reaching the target, the IATA avoided reopening a sensitive debate on net zero, as the bosses pointed to a narrow window for the industry to meet its goals. But they stepped up criticism of energy companies, accusing them of adding arbitrary charges in Europe, and plane makers that have failed to deliver efficient jets on time. The IATA director, General Willie Walsh, said, quote, "We still have time to get there, but we do need to see more action on the part of all the partners in the value chain to make sure that the industry can get there," unquote. In April, Walsh had issued a warning that the net zero emissions agenda was sliding off course in comments that appeared designed to trigger discussion about the challenges. But on June 3rd, Walsh said there had been no talk of any delay in the target at the annual meeting in New Delhi. The industry's sustainability efforts are largely centered around plant-based sustainable aviation fuels, called SAF. But with current supplies covering just a fraction of the airline's fuel needs, carriers have urged governments and energy firms to do more. IATA's chief economist, Marie Owens Thompson, said, quote, "The oil companies are obviously not producing enough SAF," unquote. The energy industry insists enough SAF is available in Europe for the time being, after a spate of investments, with some executives and analysts saying the markets are oversupplied. Carl Nyberg, a senior vice president at SAF producer Neste, N-E-S-T-E, said, quote, "Contrary to what some are saying, we believe we have an oversupply situation currently in the SAF market," unquote. Now, Carl Nyberg said he believed the issues were more to do with price, as the cost of ingredients for SAF means that it is currently around three times more expensive than fossil jet fuel. But Walsh said many airlines were unable to procure SAF without importing it over large distances, which would defeat the aim of reducing emissions. Now, the meeting saw a shift in tone barely 4 years after the industry committed to step up plans to tackle climate change amid pressure from regulators and environmental groups. Patrick Healy, group chair at Cathay Pacific, said, quote, "There's a level of skepticism, and perhaps you could even say sort of waning enthusiasm for the overall energy transition," unquote. And that was the article, "Airlines Stick to Target for Emissions." Now, the third article from the business section is entitled, "Wegovy Use Increases 50% Among U.S. Teens." This is also Reuters News Group, written by Chad Terhune and Robin Respot, and it comes out of Los Angeles. Families of American teens are increasingly turning to the weight loss drug Wegovy as doctors gain confidence in its use for young people with obesity, according to new data that has been shared with Reuters. The average rate of teens beginning treatment with Novo Nordisk grew 50% last year, 14.8 prescriptions per 100,000 adolescents. That's according to an analysis by the health data firm called Truveta, T-R-U-V-E-T-A. Now, that's up from the rate of 9.9 prescriptions last year in 2023, which was the first full year that Wegovy was available to children ages 12 and older. The average rate climbed further during the first 3 months of 2025. In those 3 months, it reached 17.3 new prescriptions per 100,000. Now, that still represents a minute fraction of the estimated 23,000 out of every 100,000 teens in the country who are considered obese, and it is far slower than the uptake among U.S. adults. Dr. Kate Varney, who is director of obesity medicine at the University of Virginia Health System, said, quote, "It's promising that more young people are using these medications, but it's still a very small percentage of patients with severe obesity that are getting access to them. When lifestyle changes alone are insufficient, we need these additional tools," unquote. Now, for its analysis, Truveta reviewed the electronic health records of 1.3 million patients ages 12 through 17. The data covers 30 U.S. health systems with more than 900 hospitals and 20,000 clinics across the country. The analysis did not include other GLP-1 drugs, including Novo's Ozempic and Eli Lilly's Zepbound, which are not approved to treat obesity in adolescents, or compounded versions of these therapies. Wegovy became an option to treat adolescents in late 2022. About 8 million American teens, or 23% of the people ages 12 to 19, have obesity. That's up from 5% back in 1980, according to government data. Young people with obesity run a much higher risk of developing chronic, costly, life-shortening conditions like type 2 diabetes and cardiovascular disease and liver disease. In January of 2023, the American Academy of Pediatrics strongly recommended that doctors provide weight loss drugs to children with obesity starting at age 12. And yet the medical community has not uniformly embraced GLP-1s for adolescents. Some doctors are hesitant because the drug's long-term safety for children during a critical phase of development is unknown, and the treatments may need to be used indefinitely. Overall, there are limited options for many teens and their parents because insurance plans often do not cover any treatment for obesity, including intensive behavioral counseling, visits with a dietitian, or the new GLP-1 medications. At Nemours Children's Hospital in Wilmington, Delaware, the Healthy Weight and Wellness Clinic treated about 2,000 adolescent patients last year. About 25% were prescribed Wegovy or some other GLP-1 medication, according to Dr. Thao Li Fan, who is the clinic's medical director. The number of adolescents with GLP-1 prescriptions nearly doubled from 2023, and on average, their patients taking a GLP-1 drug lost 15 pounds within 6 to 12 months and nearly 30 pounds after more than a year. For many of the other patients, the medications were not an option, either because of insurance hurdles or concerns within families about potential risk. Other teens opted for lifestyle changes or older, cheaper weight loss drugs. Fan said, quote, "It is important for us to continue to monitor and better understand the outcomes from the medications, both positive and negative, before widespread use," unquote. Now, Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. has criticized the idea of prescribing Ozempic or Wegovy widely to children to treat obesity. In a federal health report he released last month, GLP-1 drugs were cited as an example of the over-medicalization of our kids. It noted a lack of long-term safety data, raising the specter of unforeseen problems that interrupt, damage, or impair metabolism and growth development. Novo, in a statement, said semaglutide, the active ingredient in Wegovy and Ozempic, quote, "did not appear to affect growth or pubertal development," unquote, during its clinical trials involving teens. For many adults, Novo said, obesity starts in childhood or adolescence and, quote, "we are confident in the proven safety and efficacy of our GLP-1 medicines," unquote. Eli Lilly's weight loss drug, Zepbound, is in late-stage clinical trials for use by adolescents. Lilly told Reuters that, quote, "there has been no evidence to date suggesting impairment in growth or metabolism," unquote, from GLP-1 medications. Dr. Robert Siegel, a pediatrician and director of the Center for Better Health and Nutrition at Cincinnati Children's Hospital, said about 15% of adolescents being treated there were prescribed Wegovy or a similar GLP-1 medication between July 2021 to July 2023. They include patients being treated for type 2 diabetes, for which the GLP-1 drugs were originally developed. Siegel said he prefers to start teens on 3 to 6 months of intensive lifestyle management before even considering medication. While obesity specialists can help navigate potential risk from the drugs, many primary care providers need more training. They may not have the equipment to monitor for the loss of muscle mass, which is a side effect of these medicines, or they lack the resources to work with families over an extended period on healthier eating and exercise. Siegel said, quote, "These medications are likely to be needed for a very long time to maintain weight, and we only have a relatively short-term experience with them," unquote. That was the article, Wegovy Use Increases 50% Among U.S. Teens. We just passed 16 minutes past the hour, so we're going to move on over to the sports section now. At the top of the front page of the sports section is a picture of the new head coach of the Phoenix Suns. And it's a picture of, I think it's Jerome Ott, O-T-T. He's an assistant coach with the Cavs. But the title next to his picture is Search is Over. And this article was written by Dwayne Rankin for the Arizona Republic. Phoenix Suns team owner Matt Ishbia knew the type of coach that he wanted back in April. A month later, Suns general manager Brian Gregory co-signed those qualifications. The Suns wound up choosing Cleveland Cavaliers assistant Jordan Ott, O-T-T, as their new head coach. Sources informed the Arizona Republic on Wednesday, June 4th. Ott has agreed to a multi-year deal. Ott is 40, and fellow Cavs assistant Johnny Bryant is 39, were the finalists for a search that had more than 15 candidates interviewed. The Suns hope that Ott can help turn around a franchise that has greatly underachieved the last two seasons. Michael Scotto of Hoops Hype said, quote, "Jordan Ott is a bright young mind who's all about the grind. He was always going to be a head coach. The only question was when, but the answer is now," unquote. The Cavs both posted the NBA's best record in the Eastern Conference at 64 wins and 18 losses, with Ott as assistant under Kenny Atkinson, who was the 24-25 NBA Coach of the Year. Ott was a finalist for the Charlotte Hornets head coaching position last year. The Hornets went with Charles Lee, who was previously an assistant with the Boston Celtics. Scotto noted that Ott worked closely with Cavs big man Evan Mobley, the 24-25 NBA Defensive Player of the Year, who was named an NBA All-Star and an All-NBA for the first time in his career. He averaged 18.5 points on 55.7% shooting, 9.3 rebounds, and 1.6 blocks in his fourth NBA season out of USC. And Mobley made All-NBA second team and earned NBA All-Defensive Team for the second time in his career. Now, Ott was also an assistant with the Los Angeles Lakers in 2022 through 2024, and the Brooklyn Nets before that from 2016 to 2022. Scotto noted that Ott helped develop Joe Harris, who had his best NBA years with the Nets. Harris averaged a career-high 11.6 points and shot 44% from three in his seven seasons with the Nets. That would be 2016 to 2023. Ott started his NBA coaching career as a video coordinator with the Atlanta Hawks, under Mike Budenholzer, the man he is replacing in Phoenix. And that was after serving as a video coordinator for 5 seasons at Michigan State, where he earned a master's degree in athletic administration. Ishbia and Gregory also have ties to Michigan State. Gregory served as an assistant on the 2000 men's national championship team under Tom Izzo, and Ishbia was a walk-on player for that squad. Ott will be Phoenix's 4th head coach in 4 seasons after the Suns fired Mike Budenholzer after 1 season. The Suns finished 36-46 to mark their first losing season since 2019-20, which was the last time they failed to make the playoffs. Phoenix didn't even qualify for the play-in tournament this season under Budenholzer. Monty Williams and Frank Vogel and Budenholzer have been let go in each of the last 3 seasons. The Minnesota Timberwolves swept the Suns in the first round of the 2024 playoffs after winning 49 games under Vogel in the first season with the Big Three of Devin Booker, Kevin Durant, and Bradley Beal. Phoenix decided to run it back with its main core for the 24-25 season with the thought that coaching was the problem. The Suns hired Budenholzer, a 2-time NBA Coach of the Year, who coached the Milwaukee Bucks to an NBA title in 2020 and 2021. The Bucks defeated the Suns in 6 games of the 2021 finals. That hire was viewed as a home run, with Budenholzer returning to his home state to coach the Suns. Phoenix started 8-1, but the season went south and ended with the Suns losing 9 of their last 10 games. Days after firing Budenholzer, Ishbia not only said the Suns will get the next head coaching hire correct, but he provided a forecast for what type of coach he wanted to select. Back in April, Ishbia said, quote, "We're going to look for someone that fits the vision of Phoenix Suns basketball organization. Someone who is going to live out exactly what I'm talking about. Someone who is a little bit grimy, a little bit grinder, a little bit tough. Have a little bit of that in them. I joke, but it's true. I'm no talent, all heart. That's my life. I will just outwork everyone. I'm going to have a coach, a front office, and players that the Phoenix community will love, because it's going to be that," unquote. Ishbia later elevated Gregory from vice president of player programming to general manager and shifted James Jones to senior advisor. James Jones' contract expires at the end of June. Gregory then took center stage as his introductory press conference last month and endorsed Ishbia's qualifications for the next Suns head coach, who assumes the job as speculation is running high the Suns will seek to trade Durant in the offseason. Gregory said in May during his introductory press conference, quote, and what he was talking about was the coach that they would seek, quote, "unbelievable basketball IQ, tremendous communicator, share our vision and what we understand that needs to be successful in basketball in this new NBA, the toughness, the physicality, all those different things, and has the ability to hold the players accountable to doing that, playing and having a systematic approach offensively and defensively. Those attributes, in addition to understanding this is what our identity is and what we're going to coach to this on a daily basis." Well, the Suns now have their new head coach. And then, in the picture of Jordan Ott, to the left of the picture is a box. And the box is entitled By the Numbers. And it lists the coaches that the Phoenix Suns have had over the years since 1968 when they started, and tells the coach's name and the years they were coaches, and then their win-loss records. And so it starts back in 1968-69. The first coach was Johnny Kerr, and he had 31 wins and 89 losses. And then 1970, and then 72 and 73, it was Jerry Colangelo. And he had 59 wins and 60 losses. And then Cotton Fitzsimmons was a coach in 96, and then 88 to 82, 92, and 1970 to 72. So I guess he was right up there at the beginning. And his coaching record, he had 341 wins and 208 losses. And then there's like names like John McLeod and Dick Van Arsdale, Paul Westfall, Danny Ainge, Mike D'Antoni, Jeff Hornacek, Earl Watson, Igor Kostkakov, and then these last 3 years, Monty Williams, 2019 to 2023, Frank Vogel, 23-24, and Mike Budenholzer, 24-25, and it lists their records off to the side. So Monty Williams, 2019 to 23, he had 194 wins and 115 losses. Then Frank Vogel replaced him, and he had 49 wins and 33 losses. And then Budenholzer replaced him, and he had 36 wins and 46 losses. So that's a little bit of information in a box called By the Numbers, and it was right next to the picture of Jordan Ott. But the article title was Search is Over. Now, at the bottom of the page, first page of the sports section, D-backs Gallen, Mart, Carroll lead road win over the Braves. This is by Nick Pecoro for the Arizona Atlantic out of Atlanta. Whether Corbin Burns makes it back this season or not, the likely reality is the Diamondbacks will not be seeing their new ace for a while, which means they could use their erstwhile ace to start pitching like one again. And for a night, at least, that's exactly what Zach Gallen did. And it doesn't hurt when the top two hitters turn in terrific performances as well. In the Diamondbacks' first game, since Burns walked off the mound with an elbow injury, Gallen fired 7 innings of one-run ball, and Ketel Marte and Corbin Carroll each blasted a pair of homers in their 8-3 win over the Atlanta Braves on Tuesday night, June 3rd, at Truist Park. Now, Gallen said of Burns, quote, obviously, we're not sure what's going on with Corbin yet. He's going to spend some time on the IL. We've all just got to pull our weight a little bit more. I don't think there's any added pressure. I think I kind of hold myself to a super high standard, whether we're at full strength or we're not. We are all going to do our part and see what we can do until Corbin gets back, unquote. Well, the victory gives the Diamondbacks back-to-back wins for the first time since May 18th and 19th, which was just before their stretch of ugly baseball that began at Dodger Stadium on the previous road trip. Facing an aggressive Braves lineup, Gallen pumped strikes and enjoyed a number of relatively easy innings, the lone exception coming in the fourth inning, when an error by third baseman Eugenio Suarez led to a pair of unearned runs. And that performance snapped a string of 4 consecutive outings without a quality start for Gallen, who lowered his ERA from 5.54 to 5.13. Now Gallen said, quote, just a little bit better command tonight, just tried to stay in attack mode a little bit more, unquote. So of the 89 pitches that he threw, 65 went for strikes. The strikes were the second most for him in a start this season. The 89 pitches tied for the second fewest. Perhaps most important, though, it was the first time since his second start of the year in which Gallen did not issue multiple walks. Gallen said, quote, basing it off last time I faced them, they were a little bit more selective, and I think tonight they came out a little bit more aggressive, just trying to make them beat me instead of beat myself, unquote. Now, Mart hit a solo shot in the first inning and a 2-run homer in the third, balls that left his bat at 109 miles an hour and 113 miles an hour, respectively. He reached base safely in each of his 5 trips to the plate, adding a pair of walks and a single. Manager Torey Lovullo said, quote, it's fun to watch Ketel get into that mode. He gets hot, he carries teams. When he's rested, this is what he looks like. He's in a very good spot, unquote. Carroll got started in the fifth inning with a no-doubt solo shot off Braves right-hander Spencer Strider, who wound up giving up 5 runs in 5 innings. Leading 5-3, Lavulo went to his bullpen to start the eighth inning. Right-hander Shelby Miller allowed a pair of ground ball singles, and with 2 outs, the Braves' Marcell Ozuna hit a hard smash to deep center field. The Diamondbacks' Alec Thomas ranged back and made a running catch just before the wall to take away a potential extra base hit. Thomas said, quote, "We were playing no doubles defense, and I know Ozuna is a pretty good hitter. I was just trying to anticipate the ball coming to me. I was already pretty much near the wall. I got a good jump on it and made the catch," unquote. A half inning later, Carroll connected for his second homer, a 3-run shot that padded the Diamondbacks' lead. Lavulo said, quote, "I think we all exhaled. I think it was a collective exhale in the dugout," unquote. That was the article, Diamondbacks Gallen Mart Carroll Lead Road Win Over Braves. Our third article from the front page of the sports section, Cardinals Offensive Combo, Key to Team High Hopes. And this is an article by Bob McManaman for the Arizona Republic. Picture for a moment this scenario for the Arizona Cardinals in 2025. Quarterback Kyler Murray passes for at least 30 touchdowns. Tight end Trey McBride and second-year wide receiver Marvin Harrison Jr. each post 1,000-yard receiving seasons, and running back James Conner cracks 1,000 rushing yards for a third straight year. Well, on the surface, it sounds at least plausible, doesn't it? Well, yeah, that's what I thought too. If each of those four playmakers were to stay relatively healthy, it doesn't seem to be that much of an unrealistic expectation, right? McBride nodded when I asked him that question during the Cardinals' latest round of voluntary organized team activities on Tuesday, June 3rd, at the club's Tempe training facility. And he said, quote, "We have so many weapons on this offense. I'm just so excited to see how offensive coordinator Drew Petsing and Kyler decide how to get the ball distributed to all these guys, because there are so many weapons, and they can't cover us all. If they try to double one guy, then the other guy is going to be one-on-one, and I'm comfortable in all our guys to win one-on-one matchups. I'm confident in all our guys to go out there and make plays when it comes to them, and I know that's going to happen this year," unquote. Well, McBride's optimism and confidence are not misguided. After all, I posed the question, and again, on the surface, it doesn't seem impossible to me. Except it probably is. And that's because the Cardinals, in their entire history, have never had a quarterback throw for 30 or more touchdowns in the same season as two pass catchers each collecting 1,000 receiving yards, and a running back also cracking the 1,000-yard rushing milestone. Believe it or not, only twice has an Arizona quarterback thrown for 30 or more touchdowns in a single season. Kurt Warner had 30 back in 2008 during the Cardinals' run to their first and only Super Bowl appearance. Carson Palmer had 35 in 2015 when the Cardinals went 13-3 and made it as far as the NFC Championship. Now, since Murray's rookie year in 2019, an NFL quarterback has passed for 30 or more touchdowns in a season 36 times. Murray has never thrown for more than 26, and he did that in his very first season. Back in 2008, the Cardinals featured 3 receivers with 1,000 or more receiving yards. Larry Fitzgerald, 1,431, Anquan Boldin, 1,038, and Steve Reston, 1,006. Their leading rusher that season was Edgerrin James, who finished with just 514 yards. Now, when Palmer set the single-season franchise record with 35 touchdown passes, the Cardinals had two pass catchers reach 1,000 yards, Fitzgerald with 1,215 and John Brown with 1,003. But Chris Johnson was 186 yards shy of getting the 1,000 yards. Maybe it's time for history to be rewritten. Connor and McBride, after all, are each coming off 1,000-yard seasons. Considering how important this season is for Murray and how everyone seems to be expecting Harrison to make a jump in production from year one to year two, 2025 could be a momentous occasion. Now, the odds might be against it, but McBride won't put anything past the Cardinals' offense, which is now in year three under coach Jonathan Gannon and Petzing. It is a more sophisticated system these days, McBride says, adding that the schemes and concepts have been built more elaborately. He said, quote, "From the first year they were here to where we are now, the plays they're putting in, it's not as fundamental. It's not as basic. They're adding a lot of motions, a lot of sauce, is what I call it. They're just putting a little extra flavor on the same plays we have," unquote. And then he went on and said, quote, "It's definitely a lot more complex," unquote. Well, the most compelling player to watch will be Murray, entering his seventh NFL season. No one is under more pressure or scrutiny than the former number one overall pick. He has yet to pass for 30 touchdowns or hit the 4,000-yard passing mark or win a playoff game. If this offense is to truly shine and seek new heights, Murray needs to be much better than just good. He turns 28 in August and is in dire need of a career year. McBride said, quote, "Kyler obviously is one of the best athletes I've ever been around. He's a guy who was the number one overall pick. He does everything the right way. He is tremendous. So for him, I mean, the sky really is the limit. He can do anything. I've seen him make tremendous passes. I've seen him do all of that. So I'm confident that he can throw for however many yards he wants to throw for. And he can rush for just as many," unquote. Well, if Murray throws for 30 or more touchdowns, and McBride, Harrison, and Connor all reach 1,000 yards, the Cardinals will almost certainly be a playoff team. It's a compelling thought. It even has Cardinals defensive coordinator Nick Rallis curious. He said on June 3rd, quote, I love the competition we have right now. Just thinking about the past couple of days, certain guys making contested catches. They can't make a catch in practice without looking at me and talking to me. Marvin doesn't say anything. Marvin makes a great catch. He doesn't really give me much. It's been a lot of familiar faces that, let's be honest, I've been talking a lot of smack to for a few years. And I love going back and forth in practice. Even when they make a play in the moment, like I'm pissed, I want to make those plays, but I also know they're making us better. We need to make those plays on Sunday for us. So yeah, I love what we're doing. I know Drew is super innovative. Like every year, there's going to be new things that he presents to us. And I'm like, whoa, what was that? Where was that been? Like, I don't even know what to do for that. And that was Cardinals offensive combo, key to team's high hopes. At 38 minutes past the hour, we have finished the front page of the sports section. Well, I think we have time for a couple of sports briefs, little teeny paragraphs here. This one's from Paris. Coco Gauff huffed and puffed into the French Open semifinals with a 6-7, 6-4, 6-1 victory against fellow American Madison Keys in a match both players will be quick to forget as they broke the 100 unforced errors barrier on Wednesday. More than half of Gauff's points came from Australian Open champion Keys' soft mistakes, and the world number two got away with a total of 10 double faults. The 21-year-old will need to make dramatic adjustments when she faces either France's Loïs Boisson or Russian sixth seed Mira Andreeva for a place in Sunday's final. Keys, who was looking to reach the last four at Roland Garros for the second time after 2018, bowed out with her 60th unforced error to end a forgettable contest. Goff said, quote, "I'm happy to get through this match today. I have a lot more work to do. I'll be ready tomorrow," unquote. Goff, who reached the final here in 2022, is the youngest woman to claim 25 main draw wins at Roland Garros since Martina Hingis back in 1995 to 2000. Our second little sports brief. Ali Sendor's first half brace and two goals by second half substitute Lynn Biondolo helped the U.S. women's national team continue its dominance over Jamaica with an easy 4-0 victory in a friendly match in St. Louis on Tuesday. Sentmore scored in the 19th and 28th minutes, and Fallon Tullis-Joyce recorded her third shutout in as many careers. That should be no surprise. The U.S. has won all six matches in the series by shutout, scoring at least four goals in each. Biondolo made it 3-0 in the 60th minute, minutes after coming off the bench. She capped the scoring in the 88th minute on a cross by Avery Peterson for her 24th goal. Avery Patterson got her first U.S. assist. Now, the U.S. had huge advantages in shot attempts, 23 attempted by the U.S., 2 by Jamaica, and shots on goal, 10 and 0, 10 by the U.S., 0 by Jamaica, and corner kicks, 12 and 0, and they maintained an 82.4% possession time. So those were two sports briefs. And now, at 42 minutes past the hour, we're going to switch over and read an opinion piece. Lori Roberts' column is entitled, "Close a Failing School? That is No Left-Wing Conspiracy." Striking a blow for actual academic standards, the Arizona Board of Charter Schools has voted unanimously to continue the process of shutting down the woefully rated Primavera Online School. Or, to put another way, the process of shutting off the taxpayer-supplied cash pipeline into the Primavera owner's bank account. The board is standing resolute, despite the support for Primavera from some of the state and the Internet's most conservative leading lights. Already, the cries of persecution have begun as the result of the 10-0 vote on June 3rd. Damian Creamer, a major donor to the Republican Party, called the board's refusal to back off, quote, "a grave injustice and a tremendous disservice to all of Arizona's students, parents, and teachers," unquote. He wrote on social media, quote, "This reckless action threatens to dismantle a vital educational institution that has faithfully served our community, providing innovative, accessible, and high-quality education to hundreds of thousands of students since our inception," unquote. Alas, high-quality payments went to his bank account as well. 12 News' Craig Harris has reported that Creamer pocketed $24 million in public money for his for-profit charter school operation since the year 2016. And in return, we have gotten a school that delivers lousy results. Primavera, which also operates as American Virtual Academy, is the only charter school in Arizona that the State Board of Education has slapped with a D rating in each of the last 3 years. Now, the State Charter Board, meanwhile, has given Primavera its second worst rating of does not meet standards over the last 2 years. And its worst rating, which is falls far below standard, they've given it to them 4 times since the year 2017. And yet the school continues to get a heapin' helpin' of our money, nearly $80 million last year. In March, the charter board voted to begin the process of revoking Primavera's charter because of 3 consecutive years of D-letter grades. Creamer contends that his school caters to at-risk students and would not have received a D grade had it been classified as such, given lower state standards for such schools. Instead, it would have been a C school, which is apparently good enough to keep the gravy train moving. But here's the thing. The school did not apply for at-risk status during the 3 years under review, nor did it appeal its 3 years in a row D grades, according to Sean Ross, who's executive director of the Arizona Board of Education. None of which seems to bother the far right, which is inventing a narrative that this is somehow a leftist attack on the school choice movement. Senate President Warren Peterson called it a witch hunt. Earlier this week, he sent a letter asking the charter board to back off, contending the school meets state standards, or it would have had if Creamer had submitted the proper paperwork. Far-right activist Laura Loomer, when she's not busy convincing President Donald Trump to fire his National Security Council staff, she's also piled on, calling the drive to cut off public cash to Primavera a, quote, total political hit job. In March, she wrote, quote, a lefty reporter named Craig Harris News wrote a hit piece about the Arizona-based Primavera Charter School, and now they're having their charter revoked, unquote. Well, then she went on and wrote, the media knows President Donald Trump wants to dismantle the U.S. Department of Education and allow free market solutions to take charge, which is why they are now attacking the private school operators, especially those with founders who are conservative. Mark my word, this will be the next form of lawfare to take place in America, unquote. Yeah, sure, it's a big conspiracy, one now being carried out by a board chock full of charter school supporters. Board member James Swanson said during his June 3rd meeting, quote, there's been a notion out there, expressed by some, that this process is run by activists that are anti-school choice. I am fully in favor of school choice. I am in favor of quality school choice, unquote. Well, speaking of quality, just 9% of Primavera students tested at grade level in math last year, compared with 32% statewide. 23% of them were proficient in English language arts, compared with 40% statewide. Granted, many of Primavera students are considered at risk, but on what planet is 9% proficiency considered good enough? On what planet is the public paying $80 million a year to a school that produces a 9% proficiency rating considered good enough? Well, you can look for Creamer to appeal the June 3rd decision. He wrote, quote, Primavera will not stand idly by while the educational futures of our students are jeopardized. We are prepared to take all necessary action to challenge this decision and protect the rights of our students, parents, and educators. The board's actions will not go unanswered, and we will fight tirelessly to ensure that Arizona families continue to have access to the exceptional education Primavera provides, unquote. There is, after all, money to be made, young minds to educate. And that was Lori Roberts' opinion piece, Close a Failing School? That is no left-wing conspiracy. And at 49 minutes past the hour, we're going to move on over to the entertainment section now and begin by reading today's horoscopes. We will begin with the sign of Aries. Birth dates from March 21st to April 19th. Are the clouds of confusion parting? Mercury's connection to Mars grants initiative. Tackle the problem that has been eating at you all week. For Taurus, birth dates from April 20th to May 20th, are you finalizing a contract? Expect a speedy turnaround in a financial or home improvement matter. For Geminis, birth dates from May 21st to June 21st, are you trusting a gut instinct? The solution to a problem that has plagued you all week presents itself today. For Cancer, birth dates from June 22nd through July 22nd. What did you dream about last night? A nocturnal message inspires you to act. For Leos, birth dates from July 23rd through August 22nd. Are you taking the helm? Well, today's harmonious connection between Mercury and Mars presents a chance to flex your competitive muscles. For you fellow Virgos out there, birth dates from August 23rd through September 22nd, are you letting them know that you mean business? A subtle power move cements your success. For Libras, September 23rd through October 23rd birth dates, are you being blunt? Mercury's harmonious connection to Mars inspires a brutally honest conversation. We love to see it. For Scorpios, October 24th through November 21st birth dates, expect minimal resistance as Mercury and Mars harmonize. Refuse to take no for an answer. Make your move. For Sagittarius, November 22nd through December 21st birth dates, are you having enlightening conversations? Pondering another's perspective will inspire a bold move. Your inner activist awakens. For Capricorns, December 22nd through January 19th birth dates, are you trusting your inner animal? Well, acting on instinct reinvigorates a stalled work or health issue. For Aquarius, January 20th to February 18th birth dates, a friendly competition? Well, you know when to play and when to lay down the law. And finally, Pisces, birth dates from February 19th to March 20th. Are you refusing to shy away from the issue? Quick thinking helps you tackle a tricky subject. And that was today's horoscopes. We turn now to letters of advice written by Abigail Van Buren. The first letter goes like this. Dear Abby, my son is a loving husband, father, and son. He coaches his 12-year-old son, my grandson, in various sports, and sometimes he's just a spectator. I'm worried because he often berates his son's playing ability. He has yelled at him during and after games, whether he is coaching or not. He yelled and screamed at him in front of everyone, and later at home. I've told my son, to no avail, that it's okay to give constructive criticism, but without the yelling. I also have told him how it crushes my grandson each time he does this. My daughter-in-law is also at a loss for how to change his behavior. My husband coached my son in sports when he was young, and he was hard on him too. I love my family dearly, but I don't know what to do in this situation. Abby, what do you think we should do? Signed, Heartaching Grandma in New Jersey. Dear Grandma, your son may be a loving husband, but he could use some coaching as a father. Someone should point out to him that when a parent bullies a child about his poor athletic performance, it rarely produces a positive result. It makes him lose interest in the sport and damages the youth's self-esteem, and the effects can sometimes last a lifetime. After your grandson has had enough of the verbal abuse, don't be shocked if he drops out of the sport. Your son should have learned from the terrible example of his own father's that this kind of coaching usually does not produce the desired result. He should take out his aggression elsewhere. Our next letter goes, Dear Abby, 2 years ago, my mom invited all of my family on an international trip during the month of October. 1 year ago, my sister called me asking if I could cover some things for her. When I agreed and asked why, she said she and our parents were going on the international trip 4 months early. Well, I was shocked. No one had said the departure date was being moved up. When I asked my other sister about it, she was also still under the impression that we were going in October. When I brought it up to my mom, she got very defensive and said we were all invited to come. No, we were not. The plans changed, and only one sister and her family were included. They are on the trip now, and I don't want to be any part of it. They are posting pictures to our family group chat, and I have decided not to look at them. I'm not sure how to move forward from here. I'm sad and frustrated over this, while they're pretending everything is fine. Signed, Left Behind in Colorado. And Abby responds, Dear Left, when your mother and sister return from that trip, there needs to be a frank family discussion about what went wrong and why neither felt it was necessary to inform you that you and your other sister were excluded and why. Pretending something that happened, never works out. And if it isn't repaired, the fallout can be long-lasting. Don't forget, you can always contact Abby by going to her website, www.dearabby.com. And now, who is celebrating a birthday today? Well, happy birthday to singer and guitarist Freddie Stone. He's in the group Sly and the Family Stone. He turns 78 today. TV host and financial advisor Susie Orman, she turns 74 today. Producer Kathleen Kennedy turns 72. Saxophonist Kenny G turns 69 today. Actor Jeff Garlin turns 63. Author Rick Riordan turns 61. Actor Ron Livingston turns 58. Singer Brian McKnight turns 56. And actor, rapper, and model Mark Wahlberg turns 54. And comedian and actor Nick Kroll turns 47. And bassist Pete Wentz from the Fall Out Boys, he turns 46 today. Happy birthday to all of them. May they enjoy celebrating another year. Well, we've reached the end of our time together, so I'm going to have to say goodbye. I'm Gene, a volunteer reader with Sun Sounds of Arizona, and you have been listening to the reading of the Arizona Republic, the second hour, and this is Thursday, June 5th, 2025. I hope you have a great day ahead, and I hope you keep on listening. Bye-bye.